Certainly grateful for the invitation to come and be with you this weekend. It's good to be back here and to see familiar faces. And we're certainly looking forward to these next few days here as we get to spend time together in the study of the Word of God. And I hope that throughout these five lessons, you'll take these things that I have to say and test it by God's Word. And if we find it to be the truth, I hope that we can take and make practical application of it in our everyday walks of life, and we can leave here being better servants of God in the future than we've been in the past. You know, change is a part of life. No matter what walk of life somebody is in, there are changes that take place. We can look at our life, we can look at the lives of those around us and see changes that are being made. You look at a kid as they grow older, there's a lot that changes. From a stage where they have to be held and taken care of to a stage where they begin to walk and talk, to go to school, to grow up, to have their independence. There's a lot of change that takes place. Not just in children do we see that. We see that in adults. As adults, as we gain experience in things, there are things about us and how we go about things that change. I want you to think about the workplace for just a minute. If you're working a job and you've got two people working the same job, and one's been at it for 3 years and another's been at it for 33 years, that one that's been at it for 33 years is going to know and have changed a lot. You expect more out of that individual than the one that's been at it for 3 years. They haven't had the time to learn. But as that one has that 30 years more experience and he's changed, he's learned a lot. Change is part of life. We see it in many areas. But not only is change something we see, let me suggest to you that change is a necessary part of life. Now we're going to look in a minute at the fact that it's necessary spiritually, but it's necessary in life just as a whole. We said a moment ago that children change from a young age to growing up, or adults as we gain experience, you expect to see some changes, some maturity. You expect to see a difference. Again, going back to our illustration, between the worker that's been there 3 years and 33 years. Change is necessary. We should be working and improving at things. That's true in every walk of life, but it's particularly true in spiritual life. We're either changing for the good or for the bad. But spiritually, we're never standing still. If we spend very long not working towards improving, we're going to begin to digress. Change is part of life, and we need to be working for the good change and growing spiritually as Christians. And as we grow and as we mature, that's a good change that's made. Change is part of life. Well, let me suggest to you that throughout the Bible, there are a number of characters that, as we look at, they make some changes, some for the good and some for the bad. Some were doing what was right and then fell away. Others were not doing what was right and then came to serve God. But there are many Bible characters, as you turn throughout the pages of the Scriptures, you find that have made some kind of change in their life. And there are a lot of lessons we can learn from these characters and looking at their life and what they were and what they became and what led to that change. So over the next 3 days, as we study together, what we want to explore is some character changes, some Bible characters who made some very drastic changes in their life. And then we want to look at what it was that led to those. And as we look at these things that led to them making changes, it can either, if we realize we're not in the right condition, help us realize we need to change. Or even if we're serving God faithfully, it can help strengthen us and help us to grow stronger as we look at these things. So what we want to do is we want to look at five characters, but one of these is a group of characters who made some kind of change and what it was that led them to make such a drastic change in their life. So this evening we want to talk about somebody that changed from being wise, who then became worldly, who then became wise again. That's Solomon. Lord willing, tomorrow evening we want to talk about somebody who went from denying the Lord to dying for Him. That's Peter. Talk about one that was on the verge of suicide and then obtained salvation. That's the Philippian jailer. Those that were the crucifiers of Christ to becoming Christians. That's the group of characters, about 3,000 on the day of Pentecost. And then one who was a persecutor of the church and of the faith, who then became persecuted for the faith. That's the Apostle Paul. And what we want to do is we want to take a look at each of these characters and those changes they made in their life and what it is that led them to make that. And then take those things that they did and realize there's some application for you and I to improve in our life. What we want to do in each of these studies is we want to take a look at each of these descriptions of them. So, for example, tonight we want to look at Solomon, and he's described as wise. And then there's a time where he's worldly, and then he comes back, and then we'll come back and look at what caused that change. Let's begin this evening as we talk about from wise to worldly to wise, and Solomon. Let's begin by talking about the fact that Solomon was very wise. Go to 1 Kings chapter 3 with me. Go to 1 Kings chapter 3. In 1 Kings chapter 3, this is where God comes and ask Solomon what it is that he would have. God told him to ask of him and to give it to him. Look at beginning at verse 3. Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. And the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness and righteousness and in uprightness of heart towards you. And you have kept from him, this great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in the place of David my father, although I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to govern this your great people?" Now here, as God comes and asks Solomon, "What is it you would have me give you? Ask and I'll give it to you." Solomon could have asked for many different things. In fact, verse 11, God said to him, "Because you've asked for this and have not asked yourself for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemy, but has asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, now I will do according to your word." Here, God comes and asks Solomon, says, "Ask and I'll give it to you." You've heard the illustration before, he was given a blank check. That's what Solomon in reality had. "Ask and I'll give it to you." And Solomon says, "Give me wisdom, that I can learn how to guide your people." And because of that, God gave him wisdom, and he gave him those other things. The long life as long as he would serve him. He gave him the life of his enemies, and he gave him riches. But Solomon here, when God comes and says, "Ask and I'll give it to you," he says, "Give me wisdom." And then throughout the life of Solomon, we see that wisdom exemplified. Go down to verse 16 of the same chapter with me. Verse 16 now. "Then two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, 'Oh my Lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. Then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth, and we were alone. There was no one else with us in the house, only we two were in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. And she arose at midnight and took my son from beside me while your servant slept, and laid him at her breast, and laid her dead son at my breast. When I rose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I had born. But the other woman said, 'No, the living child is mine and the dead child is yours.' The first said, 'No, the dead child is yours and the living child is mine.' Thus they spoke before the king." Now we'll pick up in verse 23 in a moment. But you take this situation here. These two women come before the king and they say, we each had a child, and one's child has died. And the one whose child has died comes and takes the accusation is she's taken the living child from the other woman and laid him next to her, and then took her dead child and laid it next to the other woman while she slept. And you can imagine they're arguing back and forth here. And no, it's my child. And the other says, no, but it's my child. The living child is mine. And Solomon here is going to have to try to discern between them. This is what he said, verse 23. And the king said, the one says, this is my son that is alive and your son is dead. And the other says, no, but your son is dead and my son is a living one. And the king said, bring me a sword. Now, if you pause for just a second in the story, and you're not familiar with what takes place next, when you read that for the first time, you're probably thinking, why do you want a sword? What are you going to do with it? He says, bring me a sword. So a sword was brought before the king, and here's what he was going to do with it. He said, divide the living child in two and give half to the one and half to the other. Solomon says, we're going to take the sword and divide the child in half. You can't decide on whose he is. Half of the child goes with one woman, and the other half goes with the other woman. Look at what happens then in verse 26. Then the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for his son, oh my Lord, give her the living child, and by no means put him to death. But the other said, he shall be neither mine nor yours, divide him. The woman who's really his mother says, just let the other woman have the son. Have the child. Don't kill the baby. And the woman whose son it was not was willing to let him be divided. And the point is, Solomon here shows great wisdom in this situation where he knew the mother who really loves his child is not going to let anything bad happen to him. The other one, she didn't care enough to stop him. And so he said, give the living child to the first woman, verse 27, and by no means put him to death. She is his mother. Now we're looking at that story here just simply for this point. This story here where they come and are arguing before Solomon, he by asking for the sword to divide the child, shows wisdom and understanding and discerning between them. And he knew that the woman that really loved the child, the one whose child it really was not going to allow any harm to fall that child. It shows us the wisdom of Solomon. But not only does that story show us the wisdom of Solomon, just one chapter over in 1 Kings chapter 4, and in verse 29 beginning, it says that his wisdom surpassed that of all the people of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. Look at verse 29 of 1 Kings chapter 4. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all other men. And so here it talks about Solomon's wisdom. It's greater than that of the people of the East. It's greater than the wisdom of Egypt. The people of Egypt were known for their schools and teaching and their wisdom. And it says Solomon's wisdom's greater than theirs. It's greater than that of the East. In fact, there are those, as you read in the Bible, that would come from far and wide to hear of the great wisdom of Solomon. So we look at that to say and understand, Solomon was somebody with a lot of wisdom. Described as far greater than all other men in verse 31. But then there's a time in Solomon's life that Solomon goes from being this man with his great wisdom to there's a time he's now living a worldly life. Go to chapter 11 of 1 Kings. There was a time this wise man then shifts from being wise to being worldly. Look at 1 Kings 11 beginning at verse 1. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. Here's Solomon. He's married to all these women. All these women, verse 3, 700 wives and 300 concubines. Solomon's married to a lot of women. Solomon had a lot of women in his life. And these women were from places, some of these women were from places God said, you don't need to marry them. In fact, look at verse 2 again. He said in verse 2, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. gods. Exodus 34:16. That's where that's taken from. It says, and you take of their daughters for your sons, and their daughters swore after their gods, and make your sons swore after their gods. And what he said was, you don't marry the people of the land. If you do, your children are going to go after their gods. And the Bible says in verse 2 that it's those women, the ones from those nations which God said do not marry. It's from those that Solomon clung to, verse 2 of 1 Kings 11, in love. And because of that, eventually those women turned his heart away from serving God. It said in verse 3, he had 700 wives who were princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Solomon had a lot of wisdom. We already saw that. And in spite of that wisdom, there came a time where he let others pull him down, and he turned away from serving God. His heart had turned from God, according to verse 3 of 1 Kings 11. He's no longer in the right relationship with God. He's living a worldly life. He's going after the things they are. Verse 4, for when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. He went after the gods of the world, the gods that his wives served. And it said, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God. Verse 4. In fact, later on, this story is brought up in the book of Nehemiah as an example to Israel about what worldly influences can do, particularly in the marriage relationship. And let me suggest to you something we need to look at and understand about the type of influence or the things that worldly influences can do to us. In Nehemiah chapter 13, to set the background, after they've rebuilt the wall and everything, the law is read before the people. And as the law is read, it says, here's what you need to do. And the people say, we're going to do that. And then they get to another commandment and he says, here's what you need to do. And the people say, we're going to do that. And Nehemiah is gone for a time, and when he comes back, those things they said we're going to do, or the things they were told not to do, and they said, we're not, we won't do what God told us not to do. Guess what? That's exactly where we find them. And one of those was, you don't need to intermarry with the people of the land. And when Nehemiah comes back, he finds them marrying with people of the land, intermarrying with the people of the land in verse 23 and 24. And this is what it said then in verse 25. And I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Now listen to verse 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, send out an account of such women? Among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Later on, they look back at Solomon and say, listen, you don't think you're going to be impacted by this. Solomon, despite all his wisdom, he fell because of many foreign women. And it served as a reminder and a warning to the people of Israel that you don't need to be influenced in marrying the people of the land, because it will impact you, just as it did Solomon as they turned his heart away from serving God. Solomon was wise. Solomon then turned away and became worldly. But I believe the evidence in the Bible would suggest Solomon came back to wise, but this time he came back to an even better wisdom. Less just the wisdom of man and wisdom from above. Let's give some evidence of that, and then we'll come back in just a moment and talk about what it is that caused this change. The book of Ecclesiastes, I believe, is written by Solomon. I believe the evidence would suggest it's written by Solomon. In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and in verse 1 it says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. In verse 12 he said, the preacher have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And so the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes is described as the preacher, the son of David, and king in Jerusalem. He's described then in verse 12 as king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now remember, after Solomon, the kingdom divides, and we know the southern kingdom is Judah. The evidence being that it's the son of David and he's king in Jerusalem. And here's one with great wisdom, and there's even more evidence that time would not permit us to go through this evening, which suggests that the book is written by Solomon. But now, not only does the book seem to be written by Solomon, it appears that this book is written near the end of Solomon's life. It appears it's written by near the end of Solomon's life. There's some debate as about who the writer is and when the writing takes place. And again, we don't have time to go through all that this evening. But many of those who believe Solomon wrote the book believe that he wrote it near the end of his life. That this is the perspective of somebody that's older looking back at mistakes that were made. In fact, that's exactly the perspective of the writing. Is it seems to be an older man warning younger people about the pitfalls of life and reminding them about what's truly important. That's what Ecclesiastes is about. And so as you read through Ecclesiastes, and we'll survey some of that here in a moment as we talk about this change in Solomon. As you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, it's really about filling a void in the life of Solomon. Or the writer, which again I think is the evidence suggests to Solomon. And throughout the book, he talks about all the many things he's tried before finally he comes to, at the conclusion of the book, about what is truly important. And what he said in verse 13 and 14 of Ecclesiastes 12 is, it's the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. And so if Ecclesiastes is written at the end of Solomon's life, and I believe it is, then it appears he's come back to serving God because after a time away, he's realized, here's what's truly important. What it is that in this time I've been missing. And so with that in mind, and I believe the evidence again suggests that Solomon comes back to serving God. He was wise, but he had an earthly wisdom. He then turned to become worldly, but now he's come back to a wisdom, a far greater wisdom, that that's described as wisdom from above, according to the book of James. And so Solomon went from being wise to being worldly to being wise. But let's spend the rest of our time this evening talking about that change from wise to worldly to wise. Mostly that second change. What made that good change to come back in the life of Solomon? But before we get to that, let's talk about the first change, and that is going from being wise to being worldly. What caused Solomon to make his first change? Well, what made him go from being wise to being somebody that was worldly is he let women pull his heart away. Look at 1 Kings 11 again. 1 Kings 11, and in verse 3, he had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Nehemiah 13, 25 through 27, again, we saw it a moment ago. He confronts them and says, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? So what caused Solomon's change is these influence of his many wives and concubines. You see, it is that worldly influence has impacted Solomon. Now in particular, the marriage relationship. And in the marriage relationship, nobody will impact you more than the person you marry. But not even just in the marriage relationship. Any worldly influence can cause us, if we're not careful, to find ourselves in the same boat Solomon was in 1 Kings chapter 11, where we then go after the things of the world. You see, these worldly influences impacted Solomon. You can imagine as he's serving God, but he's got these many wives, and there's this wife over here who worships the God of this nation, and this wife over here who worships the God of this nation, and that's going to have an impact on him. So you give them places to worship their God, do you think that's not going to impact him? It did. And something to understand is if it impacted him, and what I think the Bible points out is it'll impact us too. That's the point Nehemiah made. Again, particularly about the marriage relationship. But I think the principle holds true in any relationship, and that is those you're close to are going to impact you and influence you. And as you look at Nehemiah 13, and as Nehemiah comes to the people, he points out, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? And then he goes to talk about some of the good things about Solomon to remind them, I think, if he did it, you can do it too. He said, among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. There was nobody like Solomon. We already looked at the passage about how great his wisdom was. And he points out, nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin, verse 26. Shall we then listen to you and do this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women? If they influence somebody with that kind of wisdom, the point is they can influence us too. So what we want to do is we go throughout these series of lessons, we're talking really about making the kind of changes they made that were positive changes. But we can't look at Solomon without talking about the mistakes he made and letting these women pull away his heart. And the lesson we need to learn from that is, if he could be impacted by others, by worldly influences, despite his great wisdom, we can too. And so we need to be careful that we don't fall into the same pitfall that Solomon did by letting worldly influences turn us away from God. But now let's talk about the positive change, okay? He let these many wives turn his heart away. But Solomon then, as we pointed out, seems to come back to serving God. And as Ecclesiastes would point out. So what is it that made him return to being wise? He was wise, and then he was worldly. What made him come to being wise? What made him return? I think there are three things the book of Ecclesiastes would point out that help us understand what it is that caused this change and can help us in making change in our life if we realize something is amiss. Here's what made him change. Number one, he learned all under the sun is vanity. Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. And as you look through Ecclesiastes, you're going to find two phrases occur an awful lot. Those would be the phrase under the sun, or something equivalent to it, occurs some 34 times throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is just 12 chapters. That's not an extremely long book, and yet this phrase occurs some 34 or so times, or some similar phrase. This phrase, by the way, is the reason we often talk about the importance of Ecclesiastes to young people. When one is younger, they are not as focused on eternity as they are when they grow older. And what this book reminds us of is that serving God doesn't just make for the best life in eternity, but it makes for the best life here. And that's what Solomon's learning in this, pointing out in this book. So this phrase under the sun occurs some 34 times. So we're talking about the here and the now. The other phrase that occurs several times is the phrase vanity. That occurs some 37 or so times, vanity or some form of it. So again, Ecclesiastes 1:1-3, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. There's five times right there that vanity or vanities occurs in one verse. Verse 2, what does man gain by all the toil which he toils under the sun? There's our phrase under the sun. Again, that occurs some 34 or so times. So that's what's under consideration, is that which is under the sun. And Solomon says that these things are vanity. Now the word vanity has to do with that is a mist or a vapor or a mere breath. We're probably more familiar with that idea of a vapor or a mist from the passage in James about our life being like a mist. And when we go to that passage, we say, is it life but a vapor? It's here and it's gone. And what Solomon's pointing out in Ecclesiastes is, look at all the stuff under the sun. It's like a vapor. It's here and it's gone. You think about these last few days as the temperature's been a little bit cooler. And you go outside, sometimes when you breathe, you see your breath. It's there, and just like that, it's gone. And we often use that illustration to talk about life, but again, that's what Solomon says everything here is. That is, everything in this life is temporary. It's here, but eventually it's all going to be gone. You can't take it with you when you go. And when this world is destroyed, the things that are here, they're going to be gone. And Solomon comes in this book to realize that all under the sun is vanity. And it's this realization that leads Solomon to realize that happiness is not found on earth, on the things of earth. You can't focus on the things on earth and think that's going to bring you to be truly happy and fulfill your life. That's going to be what makes you whole. That's not going to do it. We'll come back to that more in a moment. In fact, that leads us to the next point. He realized it's all vanity. And instead, what he needs to focus on is not all the things under the sun, but realizing he needs to fear God. And he needs to keep His commandments. Again, Ecclesiastes 12, the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. We're going to come back to that verse in a minute. I want you to go to chapter 2 with me of Ecclesiastes. Before we get to talk about his grand conclusion, let's understand Solomon looked for happiness in anything and everything. By the way, I think this is part of the evidence that Solomon is the writer of the book. He talks about the wives. He talks about whatever he wanted he had. And we'll look at that in a moment. I think that's some more evidence that Solomon's the writer of the book because of how wealthy he was and the kingdom was in that day. But the point is that Solomon looked for happiness in anything and everything. And as you go throughout Ecclesiastes, he's going to point that out. You can remember it with five W's. And the first of those is, he said he tried to find happiness in wine. That is, he's using it as representation for pleasure. Look at Ecclesiastes 2 and in verse 3. I said of laughter it is mad, and of pleasure what use is it? Go down to verse 10. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. In verse 2, he searched what is pleasure. Verse 3, I searched for my heart how to cheer my body with wine. So as you look at verses 2 and 3 and you look at verse 10, he talks about trying to cheer it with wine and he talks about this pleasure. If there was something he thought he'd find pleasure in, he tried to use it to find pleasure. He did whatever he could to try to find pleasure in life to fill that void that he found there. See, I said a moment ago, something's missing. That's really where we go from Ecclesiastes 1 to chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. Something's missing, chapter 1. Through really chapter 11, and he's coming to the end and say, here's what it is that's going to fill that void in life. And he said, I tried everything to fill that void. He said, I tried wine, I tried things for pleasure in chapter 2. Go down to verse 8 now. He said, he tried women. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and treasures of the king and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delights of the sons of man. Go back to 1 Kings chapter 11, and in verse 3, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Solomon says, you know what, I didn't find pleasure in the wine, so I thought maybe I'll find pleasure with the women. And so he has all these wives and concubines. And you know what he concluded? He didn't find the pleasure to fill that void with that. He said he tried wealth. Look at verse 6 through 8 now of chapter 2. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female servants and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who have been seen before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of the kings and provinces. You could recall that in the life of Solomon, silver became as common as rocks. Think about how common it is to see a rock. And that's about how seeing silver was in the days of Solomon because of how wealthy they were. How much they had. Solomon said, you know, I tried wealth. I thought maybe if I just accumulate more and more and more material things, maybe that will fill the void in my life. It didn't. We'll come back to that again in a moment. He said, I tried wisdom. The earthly kind. We said he went from being wise to worldly to wise, and the wisdom really before is more earthly. But then he comes to that wisdom of understanding what's most important at the end. Look at Ecclesiastes 2:12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. He said, I tried wisdom. Wine didn't help women. Wealth, that didn't fill the void. So I tried earthly wisdom. And then he says, I tried work. In verses 4 through 6, he said, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. He said, I tried work. I mean, you have in the day of Solomon, they built the temple and other great works that are being done. Solomon says, I thought, well, maybe if I fill my life with work, maybe that will fill the void in my life. Solomon says, I tried wine, I tried women, I tried wealth, I tried wisdom of the earthly kind, and I tried work. And you know what he concluded? Look at verse 17 now. Here's what he concluded, verse 17 of chapter 2. So I hated life because what is done under the sun, there's our phrase again, under the sun, was grievous to me, for all is vanity. There's that other phrase we said occurs a lot. For all is vanity and a striving after wind. What he said? Doing all these things under the sun, the wine, the women, the wealth, the work, the wisdom, those were all vanity. It was like trying to grasp or strive after the wind. Go out one day when it's very windy and try to catch the wind. Take a jar with you. Take something. Try to catch the wind. You're going to be out there for an awful long time because you're not going to be able to do it. And that's exactly the point he's making, is that felt like striving after the wind, that I was trying for all these things, and at the end, it was as if I was trying to grab the wind as it came through. It felt like all of this was just pointless. He said, that's why he said, I hated life, because what was done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after wind. What Solomon has said is, I tried everything for happiness, and what I found was, it was all temporary. It was like trying to grab the wind. It's all going to be gone. Well, now you come to the end of the book. And here's the statement that is made. The end of the matter. The end of the matter. This is the conclusion. All has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. We said it's as if when we go through Ecclesiastes, it's a journey. What can fill that void in life? What can make for the best life here and now? Solomon says, I tried everything and nothing did it till finally I realized this is the end of the matter. Here's where I came to the conclusion of what was most important. Fear God and keep His commandments. That's what's most important. He said, for this is the whole duty of man. Now, if you look at your Bible and it uses italics, you'll realize that word duty is in italics. It means it was added by the translators. More literally, it would be translated this way. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. Or he's trying to figure out what makes for the best life here. What fills that void? That's what makes man whole. That's what makes for the best life here. And now he concludes is fearing God and keeping His commandments. That's what makes for the best life. And it's this realization that leads Solomon to change and to come back to serving God, because this is what's truly important. It's not all these material things. It's about fearing God and keeping His commandments. Why did Solomon change? Well, he returned to being wise because he realized all under the sun is vanity. It's all temporary. He realized that fearing God and keeping His commandments is the whole of man. That's what would make him whole. And finally, he realized God's going to judge us. Look at verse 14 of Ecclesiastes 12. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. We said Ecclesiastes is really about what makes for the best life here. And what we just looked at in verse 13 is pointing out what really makes for the best life here and now is serving God. That's what makes man whole. But it's not just that it makes for the best life here and now. He's going to point out alongside this that fearing God and keeping His commandments is what's going to make for the best life in eternity, because we're going to stand before God in judgment. That's why he said in verse 14,
to fear God and keep His commandment, for God will bring every deed into judgment. Every deed. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 10, another passage we're well familiar with where a similar point is made in 2 Corinthians 5 and in verse 10, where it says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body." The deeds that we've done, that's going to be, we're going to be judged by that. Not only is it every deed, he says it's every secret thing. That thing somebody did and they thought they got away with. And maybe no man ever caught them. God knows. That will be brought into judgment. But not just the good thing, not just every deed and every secret thing. He says it's both the good and the evil. The good deeds and the evil deeds. The good things done in secret and the evil things. Those will all be brought before, will be brought up in judgment. We'll give an account for every one of those. And so what Solomon says is you need to fear God and keep His commandments, because that makes for the best life now, but that makes for the best life in eternity. And our goal is to be with Him, with God forever someday. You see, this is what leads Solomon to change. He realized all under the sun is vanity. Everything here is temporary. He realized they weren't going to bring true fulfillment, but only serving God and keeping His commandments could make him whole. And he realized God's going to bring every deed into judgment. And so the conclusion is, we need to fear God. We need to keep His commandments. That's the change in Solomon. He was wise. He had great wisdom, as we saw. But there came a time, despite his great wisdom, that Solomon was worldly. He was serving the gods of this world. He was focused less on serving God and giving himself wholly to God and on pleasing his wives and concubines. But thankfully, I believe, as we saw, that the evidence would suggest that he eventually repented. And he came back to being wise, but the wisdom this time was far greater than the wisdom before. Because it was the wisdom from above about that which is truly important. And that is, we need to fear God and keep His commandments. Solomon was wise than worldly than wise. And he changed because he realized that everything here is temporary. He realized that what makes for the best life here is serving God. And what makes for the best life in eternity is serving God. And as we come to a close this evening, it may be that as you look at your life, you realize, you know what, I'm not in a right relationship with God. I've not been fearing Him and keeping His commandments as I should. But the good news is that an opportunity is afforded to you this evening. An opportunity you may never have again. We hope to be back tomorrow night to sing songs, to study from God's Word. But the fact is, we don't know that we have tomorrow. We already alluded to James, where we're more familiar with the term of a vapor. Life is but a vapor. It's here for a short time and vanishes away. Life could end in a moment's notice. Not only could life end, but Christ could return. Of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but the Father only. So what that means is, the time to make correction is now. If you're here and you've not yet responded in obedience to the gospel, but you've heard the word of God, you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we not repent of your sins, confess your faith in Him, and be buried in the waters of baptism, rising to walk in the newness of life, fearing God and keeping His commandments, making for the best life here, making for the best life in eternity. Maybe you're here and you've done that, but you say, somewhere along the line, I've not been what I needed to be. Maybe like Solomon, you went to being worldly. The good news is you can make the change this evening. If you sin in a private nature, you can take it to the Lord privately in prayer, and He will forgive you if you're sincere in that. But if you sin of a public nature or would desire the prayers of the congregation, we'll pray with you and for you for God to forgive you. No matter what your need is, if we can assist you this evening in any way, would you not come forward right now as together we stand? And as we sing.